I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about health care reform. Everyone in America, it seems, has an opinion about what the health care reform changes are, but relatively few seem to be able to talk in detail about what those changes really are. We'll drill down today and talk about what health care reform does and doesn't do. We'll get help with us from two great guests, Dr. David Orentlicker, co-director of the Hall Center for Law and Health at the Indiana University McKinney School of Law, and Bob Paya, LHD Benefits Advisor. Please join the discussion by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about health care reform, revisiting the subject. We've talked about it before. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm joined by a couple of great guests, both of them veterans of the show now, been here a couple of times. Dr. David Orentlicker, who is the co-director of the Hall Center for Law and Health at IU McKinney School of Law. David, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
And I probably should do a disclosure. David was on the board of directors for what was then the Indiana Civil Liberties Union when they hired me to be the executive director. So I don't like to obscure those things. And then we also have with us Bob Paya, who is with LHD Benefit Advisors. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
It's good to have you both here. Well, let's try to establish kind of an overview here. And I'll start with David Orentlicker. You know, as I said in kind of the setup to the program, everyone seems to have an opinion about health care, but you start talking with them and you realize that they're talking often about entirely different things. What did what we call the health care reform changes laws do in an overview?
Yeah, I'd say maybe the most important thing is removing the barriers to access to insurance for the almost 50 million or so who are uninsured in this country. And there are two main ways the act does that. One is for people of very low income, Medicaid will be expanded. Right now, it's not just enough to be poor to qualify for Medicaid. You have to be poor and disabled, poor and pregnant, poor and a child, poor and a caretaker of a child. So there are a lot of poor people in this country who don't qualify. They're an able-bodied adult with no kids. So now what we say is everybody gets into Medicaid who is poor. That's all you have to do. And the level of poverty, the threshold has been raised. In Indiana, you could earn half the federal poverty level and be too rich for Medicaid. Now, everybody across the country, up to 138% of the federal poverty level, qualifies. So for a family of four, I think that's about $30,000, will qualify for Medicaid. So that's number one. And half of the newly insured under this act will come through the Medicaid expansion. Although I'm sure we'll talk about, will we have a Medicaid expansion in Indiana?
Yeah, the governor gave us a little bit of a news hook there with that last week.
But the other half then is the people who aren't poor enough for even expanded Medicaid have to buy their own insurance. The problem is, you know, if you work for Indiana University like I do, I get a great group plan, and it doesn't matter whether I have any medical conditions in my history. But the so-called pre-existing medical conditions problem, you've been diagnosed with cancer, you've had a heart attack, you have diabetes, even asthma. Your insurer, if you have to buy your own insurance as an individual, they're going to charge you very high rates because they're worried you're going to need medical care. And we've got a lot of people in this country who are just priced out of the market. The Affordable Care Act now says to insurers, you can't charge people more because they've got a medical problem. Everybody has to get standard or community rates. And this ties into the famous individual mandate. Mm-hmm. We're going to make you buy broccoli, remember?
Yeah.
Well, the only way you can tell insurers charge everybody the same amount of money is to make sure people buy insurance when they're healthy. They don't wait till they're on their way to the doctors or the hospital and say, call up Rob and say, I'm ready for my insurance. It's not fair, just like we don't let you buy your homeowner's insurance when your house is on fire. So those are the two main things, making insurance affordable for the people with the pre-existing conditions who can now buy it at standard rates, and people who are poor who need Medicaid for their health care.
And Bob, from your perspective, what are the big changes? And I'm imagining that this has had a somewhat transformative effect over what you do over the past couple of years.
Yes, that's correct, John. And David did summarize the Affordable Care Act very precisely in terms of it is an expansion of coverage and trying to deal with our uninsured population and how we address that. Obviously, from my perspective, we work with a lot of employer groups for their health plan benefits, and there's a lot in this legislation that employers need to be aware of and to be compliant with. So it does increase some of the regulatory requirements on employers' group health plans. With the Affordable Care Act, it was phased in, obviously. The law was passed in 2010, and since then, every year, provisions get phased in, with 2014 being the really big year with the individual mandate that comes up. So every year, we've had provisions that kick in, every year in different capacities. For example, for 2013, the Medicare tax increase on FICA for high-income individuals, as an example, where if you make more than a certain threshold as an individual or a family, you'll pay an additional tax for Medicare. A lot of the provisions that were passed in there, some are very popular, such as the expansion of coverage for dependent children to the age of 26, regardless of the status. They no longer be a full-time college student. So there's a lot of things that passed, but we're coming to the meat of the law, which is 2014, as David said, where the individual mandate kicks in, large employer mandate, where they need to provide affordable, qualified benefits to their employees.
We are talking about health care reform here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, in terms of the news hook that I referenced just a moment ago, the governor sent out a press release, governor's office sent out a press release last week saying that Indiana flatly refuses, that was the language in the lead in the press release, to expand Medicaid. What does that mean for the state? I'll start with David Orenlicker on that one.
Well, if we didn't do the Medicaid expansion, that would be a very bad thing. We're talking about 350,000 plus people who would not get health care, who the act is there to protect. The other thing, it's very bad for hospitals because there are a lot of parts to this bill. It was a very big bill with a lot of parts that have to fit together. And one of the important parts is, how are we going to fund all this? And one of the ways we're going to fund it is to reduce funding that hospitals are going to get under Medicare. Their reimbursement rates are going to go down by hundreds of billions of dollars over the next 10 years. The funding for what are called disproportionate share hospitals, that is, hospitals like Wishard that take care of a lot of poor people, that they don't get compensated for their care, they don't get reimbursed, and so the federal government sends them money to make up the losses. Well, because we're going to have more insured people, that disproportionate share funding is being cut. So hospitals are going to get less Medicare revenues, they're going to get less disproportionate share revenues, and how are they going to manage that? Well, they knew there were going to be a lot more insured people because of the Medicaid expansion. So they knew they could swallow the cuts because they'd make it up with the increased Medicaid revenues. Well, if they have to take the cuts and they don't get the revenues, they're not going to be able to make ends meet. And for some hospitals, that may make the difference between staying open and closing. And that's jobs in their community. That's health care access for people in their community. So there's a lot at stake here. And I think in the end, Governor Pence, like Governor Brewer in Arizona and many other governors in this country that have looked at the numbers, have come to the conclusion we have to do this. And the question is how we'll do it. And, you know, Governor Pence wants to expand the Healthy Indiana Plan. There are a lot of nice aspects of that program that the legislature passed, I think, in 2005 to make health care more affordable for low-income people. Here's the sticking point with the federal government. You know, the Healthy Indiana plan has the so-called health savings account, where you have like $1,000 that you use to pay your health care bills before your insurance kicks in. And the idea is to make patients and all of us individuals more conscious of costs when we're seeking our health care. But there's the so-called, we want to give people skin in the game, says the Healthy Indiana plan. So you have to put up some of your own money. The state will put up most of that $1,000 deductible, but you've got to put up part of it yourself. And for poor people, that's just not affordable. So the federal government says you can't make this too expensive. The whole point is to make it affordable. And so there's going to be some negotiation. I think in the end, the federal government and the governor will reach some compromise to make the general Healthy Indiana plan work, but so it's not too expensive for people who are trying to qualify for Medicaid.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, if we don't expand Medicaid here in Indiana, that 350,000 Hoosiers would not be covered. What happens to those folks in that case? I mean, I'm assuming, given that it is federal law now, there's a provision somehow that has to be enforced by PIA.
Well, one of the provisions that does kick in 2014 is the individual mandate we spoke about earlier. So basically every U.S. citizen, man, woman, child, has to have health insurance, a qualified health plan, beginning January 1st, 2014. Or if they don't have a qualified plan through their employer, through an individual plan, going through the state exchange, they're going to have to pay a penalty, a tax. In 2014, the tax is relatively low. It's the greater of 1% of your income, or $95. There's also a cap for families, which I believe is a three-time cap for 2014. But that penalty does go up each year. So come 2014, if Indiana does not expand Medicaid definition, so we still have that that population out there that sort of falls in the middle. They can't get coverage through their employer. It's too expensive for them to buy on their own. In all likelihood, it's going to be less expensive for them to stay uninsured, pay the tax or penalty, and go forward. And again, eventually, as that tax or penalty goes up in 2015 and 16, at some point you expect it to become less for them to go ahead and sign up for health coverage through the exchange versus pay the penalty. But that could be years away. So obviously at this point, our governor's announced his decision. So in the state of Indiana, we could still have a significant portion of people uninsured come 2014 and decide just to pay the penalty instead.
So just so I understand this, so if we refuse to participate as a state, in effect, what we're saying is to those lower income Hoosiers, your choice really is to pay more taxes than the following year. Is that?
Well, for low income people who it's really unaffordable, they will be exempt from the penalty, right? So, if you're talking about somebody who's at 25 or 50% of the federal poverty, they should get the Medicaid expansion. If they don't get the Medicaid expansion, then the mandate will be there, but they'll have an exemption because it's unaffordable for them.
Where's the crunch, though? In that
I mean, one of the problems with all of this is Congress assumed the Medicaid expansion would be, you know, everybody would take it up. Mm-hmm. So what about people who make, you know, you're 150% of federal poverty. So, you know, your family is making, you know, maybe $35,000. You've got a couple kids and a spouse. Well, to go out and buy insurance on a $35,000 income, even if you get standard community rates, that's could be a third of your income, gross income. That's still not affordable. So you can go on to the exchange, buy your policy, and you get a subsidy. The federal government recognizes that you're not going to be able to afford your own policy, so we'll cover most of the costs. The problem is when they wrote the provision for subsidies, they said you had to earn more than 100% of federal poverty to get the subsidies, because everybody under 100% would be in Medicaid, they figured. So if you're at 50% of federal poverty, you don't have Medicaid because your state doesn't participate in the expansion, and now you don't qualify for the subsidies. So you won't be penalized by the government, but here you are, well, you'll still be uninsured and you'll have to rely on charity care. And that's just not a good way to get health care in this country.
Well, and it sounds like even that option begins to diminish. I mean, your range of options actually gets much smaller after January 1, right, Bob Paya?
The answer to that is sort of yes and no. in terms of the marketplace, in general, there has been a lot of consolidation in terms of health plan providers in the marketplace over the years. But, you know, January 1st, you have the option to go through the exchange, or if your employer offers it, you can get through your employer's plan.
We are talking about health care reform here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or shooting us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. My guests are David Orentlicker and Bob Paya. You're listening to No Limits. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about health care reform. My guests are Dr. David Orentlicker, who is the co-director, my tongue is not working today, co-director of the Hall Center for Law and Health at IU McKinney School of Law, and Bob Paya, who is with LHD Benefit Advisors. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, we were talking right before the break about, you know, the Medicaid expansion and the governor's position. The stated argument is that the governor's made, and folks who tend to agree with him, is that Indiana just can't afford this, you know, that it's going to cost too much. David Orentlicker, is that the case?
No, it really isn't, and for a few reasons. Congress understood state concerns about the cost of Medicaid, and the funding works very differently under the expansion, the new people, than under the people who already qualify. There's always been a federal-state share. In Indiana, the federal-state picks up about two-thirds of the cost of Medicaid. In New York, it's about half. New York's a richer state. In Mississippi, maybe 80% because Mississippi's a poorer state. Mm-hmm. In Indiana, it's two-thirds. Under the new expansion, for 3 years, the federal government will pick up 100% of the costs. And then they'll reduce the federal share so that by around 2019, it'll be 90%. But it's still going to be a 9-to-1 match indefinitely. And that means that if Indiana puts up maybe $60 million a year, the federal government's going to put up about $800 million a year. So we can afford it. We've got money coming in. Remember, if we're going to do this through some version of the HIP program in all likelihood, there's money coming in from cigarette taxes for HIP. There are reserves for HIP that have the Healthy Indiana Plan that have built up over the years. Governor Pence is talking about a tax cut. Mm-hmm. We've got the money. So we'll do it. And even the federal government said you can try it out for 3 years where we're picking up the entire cost. The state has time to plan for when it's going to have to share the costs. So that's why you see governors in other states like Arizona who said we're not going to do this, have come to the realization this is affordable, it's the right thing to do, and we're not going to deal with our health care problems unless we make Medicaid really a decent program.
Listeners probably have picked up on the fact that you understand how state government works pretty well, and we probably ought to put out there for the few who don't remember that you were a former state representative, Democratic representative from Indiana, so you understand the processes of state government here. We are talking about health care reform here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Anne, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Your question.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. My son and his girlfriend live together. He makes about $25,000 a year. Mm-hmm. His company will not let him put her on. Now, if he was gay and she were a guy, he could put her on his insurance. But seeing that they're a heterosexual couple, he can't. he's got his daughters on his insurance, and she just got kicked off of Medicaid because he makes too much, because the new rules say you can only make $400 and something a month. I mean, you can't even rent an apartment on $400 a month. And she's got epilepsy really bad. Her medicine is $1,200 a month. I can't afford to go in my pocket. So what do I help them do?
Thanks very much for the question, Ann. We'll see if we can get some answers for you. Well, Bob Paya, it sounds like there are a number of factors here in the scenario that Ann was talking about. First place,
I think what happened, I didn't catch all the various comments, but since their child got married, they no longer was a legal dependent, and they were claiming that child on their taxes. And with, again, the Affordable Care Act back in 2010, extended coverage for your dependent children to age 26, regardless of status. But if your child is married, you know, below that, and you're no longer claiming him or her on your tax returns, they're no longer a qualified dependent to stay on your employer's plan. So they have to go off on their spouse's plan or their plan or get an individual plan. So I think that's sort of the answer to why she couldn't put her child back on her plan. In terms of the options as we have today, depending on the size of the employer, COBRA continuation might be an option that the child could continue on their plan for 18 months, which would basically get them to 2014, where it's an individual mandate, and you can have access to individual coverage through the exchanges. That would be a sort of a short-term solution, or they could try, she mentioned some health concerns or health issues, and the individual marketplace still is fully underwritten, and carriers still can rate up or decline based on ongoing health situations. And given the feedback we heard, I think most likely her child would have a difficult time getting an individual policy. So COBRA continuation, if it's available, would probably be the best option to get into 2014.
Well, and I guess I'd like to follow up on this because the one of the things we've been talking about is, and we probably ought to step back and just attack the premise here, the estimates range that there are 30 to 50 million people in this country who don't have health insurance. David Ornitlicker, why is it important for them to have health insurance? Why don't we just let the market take care of that?
Well, because the problem with markets is they have winners and losers. And for some markets, that's important. You have to weed out the inferior products. You don't want companies that can't make an affordable, good product to stay in business. That's not good for the economy. So you want the turnover so the better mousetrap emerges. But in healthcare, like K through 12 education too, everybody deserves access and everybody deserves healthcare. And we can't say that just because you don't earn enough money, you don't deserve healthcare. And so it's a different kind of a good and a service. And we know from studies that people who don't have health care, yes, they can go to emergency rooms and doctors and hospitals will take care of them. But that's not a good way to get your health care. You're not going to live as long. You're going to get sicker because you have to wait until it's emergency. We know that if you have diabetes or asthma or high blood pressure, better to treat it with medications, keep it under control. And you'll be able to learn better in school, you'll be able to work better at your job, and you'll be able to live longer than if you go untreated and you have these periodic breakdowns where you need to get emergency care and be hospitalized.
We've gotten actually an email question from a listener named Jerry that's on this point. And if you want to send an email to us today, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry's question is, while I agree with their perspective, I think your guests have begun the discussion with some unwarranted assumptions. Specifically, a large percentage of Hoosiers, including its new governor, do not appear to accept the proposition that health care is a legitimate concern of government. You need to begin by carefully explaining to these citizens precisely why and to what degree affordable health care is any of the government's business, and whether and why it is state government's business as well as the federal government's business. Thank you very much for the question, Jerry. I'll throw that one to David Ornitlicker first.
Well, I suppose you could approach this from a number of ways. One is that one of the roles of government is to make sure we all have a fair opportunity in life. We educate our, we give a free public education to our kids. We provide a lot of services to make sure we're the land of opportunity, but we have to make sure people have the basics and that they have the food and the shelter and the education and the health care. Because if they don't have access to those basic services, they can't live up to their potential. And it's in everybody's interest that all of our citizens can live up to their potential. You know, we're all in this together. And if we have people who are unhealthy or unfed or uneducated, we're going to bear the cost one way or the other. And it's a lot cheaper to bear the cost up front and make sure people are healthy and well-educated and well-fed. I think the other thing is that our state and federal government invest a lot of money in training our doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers and building our hospitals. And we're entitled, since we put our tax money into the, you know, making sure we have good healthcare services, mm-hmm. that all of our citizens who are taxpayers get to benefit from those services.
Bob Paya, in terms of Jerry's question, I mean, do you believe government has a role in this?
Government does have a role in terms of the marketplace, but I think some of the frustration or tone you hear in Jerry's comment is we hear that a lot with our clients is sort of the intrusiveness of the law mandating that you have to have this type of coverage, and if you don't, you pay additional taxes and penalties. And we do hear a lot of that type of frustration out in the marketplace. In the sense, because the way we've operated for so many years, where if you want health coverage, you can go out and buy it yourself, get it through your employer, and now with the Affordable Care Act, it's obviously becoming a mandate. Everybody has to have it one way or the other, and so you do have some frustration out there from an individual perspective or from an employer perspective with all these new regulations and potential fees and taxes that come down through this legislation. So that comment and tone, it doesn't surprise me. We do hear that quite a bit. And it goes back to sort of David's comments in terms of, you know, where's the boundary in terms of government services where it comes too intrusive and where they are to help.
We are talking about health care reform here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Jill, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Your question,
Hi,
please.
Yes. I was listening just this morning to WFYI about the midwifery bill that's up right now in the Indiana legislation, and I was wondering if legalized licensed midwifery as an option for low and moderate income women would could somehow be worked into the Healthy Indiana plan as a less expensive childbirth and prenatal care option.
Thank you very much for the question, Jill. Well, I think we'll throw that one to the former state legislator, David Hartlicker.
Yeah, every year there are bills like that, you know, to expand the ability of non-physician healthcare providers to provide their services to patients. And this is definitely the trend of we've got to move in that direction. And unfortunately, Indiana has been slower than other states to recognize that. But the reality is we're going to have lots more people with health, millions more people who have access to insurance, and there just are not enough physicians to provide those services. Nor do we need a highly trained physician for every medical problem that people have. There are a lot of simple problems that non-physicians can handle. In this case, simple childbirth, midwives can do a good job. There are nurse practitioners who can handle a lot of the sort of day-to-day medical problems that people go to clinics and to see doctors for. And I think that's an important thing that I remember when I was in the legislature, physician assistants prescribing privileges and so on. And yes, we need to do this. It's a very smart thing to do, to use our physicians wisely where they're really needed and use other healthcare providers where they can be effective and less expensive.
Well, let's broaden this discussion because to some degree, healthcare was the start of a dialogue and it has confined. You know, we've gotten in this country to be almost adversarial about it. But there's a larger context out there, a larger perspective about, A, how we take care of ourselves, how we take care of those around us, what responsibility individuals have for their own health and maintenance, and what responsibility the rest of us have, you know, through government, to provide care for them. That obviously was part of the Healthy Indiana Plan. I mean, the whole idea of putting some skin in the game and all of that is a way, mechanism to force Hoosiers to take more personal responsibility for their own health. Are there different ways we should be approaching this, Bob Paya?
In the employer market segment, one way that employers have been trying to get to incentivize their employees is with wellness programs to try to incentivize them to lead healthy lifestyles. Because you're right, it does boil down to some personal responsibility. You can put, you can provide all the greatest coverage in the world, but if an individual doesn't take some personal responsibility to take care of themselves, that great plan doesn't do any good. So many larger employers have put wellness plans in place to try to incentivize their employees and their associates to lead a healthier lifestyle in hopes that that would keep their costs level, if not reduced, because of obviously of a healthier employee, they're less likely to miss work, be more productive, all the things that go along with that.
Is there, though, an argument to be made that, you know, I'm playing it devil's advocate here, that our responsibility as a society to provide that health care decreases if, you know, for example, both of you, do you have an obligation to take care of me if I've decided I'm going to smoke six packs of cigarettes a day and live exclusively on, you know, deep fried fatty foods and never exercise or do basic health maintenance tasks? Do we still have an obligation in that case, David Arntlicher?
Well, these
I'll
are important.
Go to Bob Paya.
Yeah, these are important.
Both nodding.
Yeah, these are important and very difficult questions. Yes, we want to encourage people to be healthy, and it's in their interest, it's in society's interest, but it's much more complicated than it first appears. You know, there's program after program where we said, let's get school kids to exercise and eat a better diet at school. And we implement it and we find out they don't work nearly like we thought they would. A lot of them make no difference. Take smoking. Yes, they did it to themselves, but almost everybody who smokes takes it up when they're a teenager. As my wife says, when they have hormonal poisoning, it's hard to hold a 16-year-old accountable.
You're going to have to use that phrase in the future.
Yeah. How can you hold them accountable? They make dumb decisions. And then they're addicted. And once you're addicted, it's easy to say if you're not a smoker, just stop smoking. But this is a powerful addiction that you took on when you really weren't competent to make these kinds of long-term decisions. So I think we have to be very careful about starting to say we need to penalize these people for something that really, it's not fair. It's obvious that we can say they really made a responsible decision and they can easily take charge and make the right decision.
Bob Paya, your turn.
No, but it brings up a good point because we've seen some examples with the Affordable Care Act. One of the provisions is, you know, when you go to your state exchange, there is a factor, a rating factor, where if you are a smoker, your premium can be 1.5 times higher than your premium, John, if you're a non-smoker. And that's created a lot of, again, upset individuals who are smokers saying I'm being discriminated against. Maybe I am addicted to it because I started when I was a teenager. I can't quit it. And now I'm going to get penalized because my premiums are going to be 1.5 times greater than someone else who's a non-smoker. We actually have this the state of New York where they're trying to legalize the large sodas, the 16-ouncers that we've heard so much about with Bloomberg, and trying to do away with that or minimize that because of the amount of sugar content in sodas and what have you. So, again, it sort of gets back to the initial discussion where, you know, at what point does the government become too intrusive with limiting the size of how much of a soda you can have, or if they're going to charge you a higher premium if you're a smoker or non-smoker, regardless of what your personal choices in that matter. So it is a difficult and complicated topic.
Yeah, let me make another point. Yeah. If you look at the big picture, you know, our health care costs are much higher than countries we compare ourselves with. But you can't blame that on our personal health habits or our personal health status. We're actually healthier than people in most Western European countries. We smoke less, we drink less, So that's not really what's causing our high health care costs.
We will pick that up on the other side. We are talking about health care reform here on No Limits. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about health care reform. My guests are Dr. David Orentlicker, who is the co-director of the Hall Center for Law and Health at IU McKinney School of Law. I am not going to get through that in this show without ruining it. Bob Paya, who is with LHD Benefit Advisors. You can join the conversation by connecting with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. David, before we went into the break, you were saying actually that it's not necessarily, we don't have an accurate picture of what the state of health is in the United States, that we are in many ways healthier than we think we are.
Yeah, exactly. If we compare ourselves with other countries on the, you know, what causes higher health care costs, smoking, drinking, if you have an older population, because people get sicker as they're older, so what's the average age of your population, obesity? If you look at all those factors, the only one that we are actually higher than other countries is obesity. We are a heavier country, but we do smoke less, we drink less, we're a younger country, our population is younger. So we have, in many ways, low reasons to think we should be lower costs. And there was a study by McKinsey & Company a couple of years ago that looked at this, and their estimate was only about 1% of our health care costs can be attributed to the health status of our population. And what concerns me, we should, you know, do everything we can to reduce abuse of alcohol, smoking, all the bad food. People should eat healthier and exercise. I'm all for that. But what we shouldn't do is to believe that we can solve our health care cost problems by just getting people to take more responsibility. That's not what drives our high health care costs. What does drive it is a very good question. But one thing we know is, as one expert, a health care economist has said, it's the price is stupid. And the reason why, you know, the riff on Clinton's is the economy stupid, is because if you look at what it would cost you to get an MRI here, and compared to if you went to Japan and got the same, as good an MRI quality-wise, you'd pay probably 10 times here what you would pay there. We just get billed much higher fees for the same services that people in other very countries with very good healthcare systems. And the reason why is that? Because in all those other countries, the government or health insurers collectively sit down every year or two and negotiate a fee schedule for hospitals and doctors, and they can use their market power. We think WellPoint and Cigna and all those other insurers have a lot of market power, but nothing like what a government negotiating, you know, sitting down once a year. And that's why Congress, when they passed the prescription drug benefit for Medicare, prohibited Congress from negotiating drug prices, because they knew, the industry knew that the government could negotiate a much tougher reimbursement than the individual insurers could. So that's one, we just pay more for the same service. The other thing is, another part of it is, healthcare is a very labor-intensive service. You know, farmers have mechanized, and automobile manufacturers can make the same number of cars with far fewer workers. But healthcare is, you want to spend time with your doctor. You don't want to spend time with a machine. And so it's a very labor-intensive industry. And our labor costs, we're a high labor cost country. So and that's why a lot of people, you may have heard of medical tourism. They need a hip or knee replaced. They go to India and pay, you know, one-fourth or one-fifth the cost. So there are some things. So until we get a handle on what we bill and what we charge, the other thing that's important is the fee-for-service problem, and this is where the health care bill doesn't try to address that. Doctors make more by doing more, and when you pay them piecework, they're going to do a lot more. One thing I say is pay doctors what they get paid now, even pay primary care more. But if you pay them on salary, they'll do. We'll end up with lower costs because, as an aphorism that's been around for a while, the most expensive medical device is the doctor's pen. It's that doctor ordering the MRI or recommending the surgical procedure. That's what drives up the costs, and we need to reduce the incentive to order those unnecessary procedures.
You hear on the other side of that that argument, though, that position, that they're ordering the extra tests basically to protect themselves from malpractice concerns. Is that a realistic argument, Bob Paya?
Yeah, that is a realistic argument. I mean, doctors are sued quite often for services that from patients they feel like they were underserved or didn't perform the appropriate tests. So, yes, in our society, they do tend to go above and beyond. But in terms of cost overall, I would state, obviously, the Affordable Care Act, as we addressed today, was really to deal with our uninsured population of 50 million people. I think sort of phase two, or the sequel to the Affordable Care Act, is really going to have to address the cost side. Because even with all these rules and regulations we have, costs are still not going down. If anything, they're going up due to all these additional fees and taxes.
We are talking about health care reform here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hello. I am wondering about the role of charitable institutions in this health care debate. It seems to me that there is perhaps a squelching or some type of annihilation of any thought that perhaps there are ways to provide health care without the government being involved. And I know that there are smaller organizations around my community where there are people who can go get free health care, it's just one of those things. I think of Doctors Without Borders, and anytime there's some sort of international tragedy, we are able to send people over there and help out. But what is the role of charitable institutions in this healthcare debate?
Thank you very much for the question, Jeff. Bob Pye, I'll throw that one to you first.
Yes, there are charitable organizations out there that do provide assistance to individuals if they don't have health insurance coverage. But some of these charities are limited in terms of, the overall benefit they can provide. In terms of assistance to an individual. So they still out there, depending on your qualifications. Many of the charities, as you know, do sort of base your qualifications for assistance based on your income. And again, certain individuals' incomes may be too high or not qualify for assistance.
Well, and is some of it the scope of if you've got 30 to 50 million people, how easy is it for a charitable organization to deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, the so-called safety net, these charitable institutions will have a role even with the Affordable Care Act, because the Affordable Care Act is going to get us to maybe 93-94% insured instead of maybe 85%. But there's still going to be millions of Americans who don't have good insurance and are going to need these institutions. However, talk to people who operate them and they'll tell you they just can't keep up with the need, especially when the economy turns and more people, food pantries just can't keep their shelves stocked in this kind of an economy, and nor can free clinics meet the demand of the people who are sick and have medical problems.
And you've worked at a free clinic, right?
Right, the Genesser Free Clinic, and it does a tremendous job. But
what is it? But what is the demand like in times like this? I mean, are you able to keep up with it? To speak to that experience, or?
Yeah, I haven't been on the board for a few years, but my sense is that you can't meet the needs of the uninsured even with a good system of free clinics. And free clinics have limits in the kinds of services they can provide. They're walk-in clinics. They're not hospitals, and hospital care, specialty care is especially difficult to provide in difficult times.
We have gotten an email from Jerry, who actually emailed earlier in the program. Normally I don't do this, but I think Jerry's comment is on point, and I'd like to reward people for listening closely. So Jerry says, thanks to your guest for responding to my first observation with a correct answer. We are all in this together. My only quibble is, we are all in it together, whether we like it or not. That is whether or not we approve of our fellow citizens' morals, quirks, lifestyles, personal health habits, etc. We have a shared responsibility to optimize the health of our citizens. It is absolutely in everybody's self-interest to do so, and that is why government exists in the first place, to do those things which we cannot do individually, but can only do collectively. I see some nods here. We are talking about health care here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Monica, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi. Your question,
please. I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you.
Really. Thank you.
Certainly, your question.
I'm asking for a correction. One of your speakers made the comment that our health is better than the developed European countries. And I'm a healthcare professional, retired, and that's just not true. Our perinatal numbers are way, way lower than any of the European countries. Our health generally isn't as good. We don't walk nearly as much as the Europeans, and I'm including England and Ireland, et cetera, in that number. We don't take our children to the doctor as often as we should. Once they're past their immunizations, it's like they've fallen off the grid. And I'm sure with the new health care legislation, that may not matter so much because parents won't be incurring extra expenses. But still, the fact remains that we are not in better health than the European community, which has had some form of social medicine backing them up.
Well, Monica, thank you. Let me give David, since we're running a little close on time, let me give David Ornbecker a chance to respond.
No, I'm sorry. I should have been clear. You're absolutely right. If you look at life expectancy, infant mortality, the measures of health status, people in other countries are better. What I meant to say was that you can't – people often say, well, if we spend more than these other countries because we have health habits that are not as good, that we smoke more, that we drink more, that our demographics, put us at a disadvantage. And my point was – and thank you for asking for this clarification. You're right. That's what I meant to say. It's not that we bring – more smoking or drinking or other, bad health habits that is responsible for our poor health. But you're right. In the end, you're going to live longer if you're in Denmark, and you're going to babies more likely to survive in those countries. And we do need to do a better job. And a lot has to do with they do a better job with prevention than we do. And a lot of factors we're not so sure about.
How much of this is a product of the success, the tremendous developments in medical technology and all of that? I mean, life expectancies have grown fairly dramatically over time. Put simply, we just have a lot more time for things to start breaking down and going wrong now. And that period of our lives in which we are in decline is much longer than it used to be. David Ornlicker.
That for sure if you look at what drives healthcare costs, a lot of it is new technology, an aging population. Because the older you are, you're right, the greater your healthcare needs. I think the average cost for an older adult is more than twice for a child. So yes, that's absolutely a big part of it, and that's good. You know, one of the things we should keep in mind: we're a wealthy country. There's nothing wrong if we're going to decide where we spend our money. I'd rather spend it on healthcare than on video games. The only concern is that we get our money's worth. If we're going to spend money on new technologies, we want to make sure it's a technology that works. And we spend a lot of money on cardiovascular stents and other devices that really don't provide the benefit they're supposed to provide. And then when we provide service operation surgeries and devices for people who can work and can provide a benefit, a lot of people get them who really don't need them. So, yes, let's spend money and live healthier, longer lives, but let's just do it in a way that's efficient and doesn't waste money.
Jack, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. Your question, please.
Well, my question starts with an observation. I began to be a student of this issue in 1972 in graduate school healthcare economics course. And I want to make the observation, which is that access to affordable, good quality healthcare is not a right. It is not enshrined anywhere in state or federal constitution. Morally, there may be an argument that we all need to take care of each other, but fundamentally, it is not a right, at least at this point. Now, that's the observation. The question is, why didn't the people who constructed the Affordable Care Act be more upfront about the payment of the necessary expenses? There are 28, I think, different ways of collecting money to the federal treasury that in turn will then flow out of the treasury to pay various bits and pieces of the federal government's responsibility under the act. Honestly, I think the only way to do it is with a public option. I would not be in favor of that personally, but I think in order to make it work, the public option is the only decent alternative. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Great. Thank you very much for the call, Jack. David Ornitlicker basically is asking, where does the money come from? How do we pay for all of this?
Well, the Affordable Care
Act. And you would get that question when we got about a minute left.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is reducing spending on Medicare because there are ways where we overspend. There's the so-called Medicare Advantage plan where instead of doing traditional Medicare, you can participate in a private plan. And it turns out the federal government has paid them more money than they should have. Competition was supposed to reduce costs. It actually increased costs. So there's various ways to cut out spending on Medicare that was excessive. And then the revenues are going to be raised. You know, as Bob mentioned, higher income people are going to pay more taxes. Medical device manufacturers are going to pay more taxes. People who use tanning salons are going to pay more taxes. So there are ways to both raise money from places where we think people can afford it, and we're going to try to reduce our spending and live more within our means. But it does cost more. But in the long run, as I think it was Jerry maybe, but somebody pointed out, if you invest in healthcare and you take care of people and you do more with prevention and early care, in the long run, we're all better off. And then it can kind of things can take care of themselves a little bit more.
I think that is going to be the last word. I want to thank both of you for joining me. David Ornitlicker, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Bob Paya, thank you very much for coming back. You're veterans. We'll have to bring you back in the future. We will be back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about the new ethical challenges presented by developments in science and technology, kind of a related subject. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alsett. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.